The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to this week's Books Podcast. After last week's excursion into politics and literature, we're going to take a breather and delve into the work of two of the hottest new writers who are currently doing the rounds of the summer festivals. They're both based in North America, but came originally from Eastern Europe. And they're both under 40. In fact, one of them's still in her mid-20s. Sickening! We'll also be following up on some of the issues that have got the comment threads spinning this week on our books website. Not least, where have all the female science fiction writers gone?
Ursula Le Guin. She's past 80 now. And she's a wonderful writer, but one looks around and wonders who's going to take her place.
But first, to the perennially vexing question of proper English. It was raised again last weekend in Guardian Review by Martin Amis, who wrote about just how much of a stickler his father Kingsley was. It's an exactingness Martin has carried on. Here he is, talking about sloppy writing.
You've, I think, said famously, literature is an act against clichés. What was it you said?
Whenever you write, the heat was stifling or she rummaged in her handbag. this is dead freight, you know.
Yes.
And by the way, I mean, the war is extended onto another sphere. People who use these mouldering novelties like seen it, done it, got the T-shirt, he went ballistic, I don't think so, hello, all that. These are dead words. They're heard words. And what cliche is heard writing, heard thinking.
Well, there were loads of fascinating aperçus in that article, but one sentence really got the scientists among you going, as it appeared to contain an error of fact. Joining me in the studio to discuss this is our Reader's editor, Chris Elliott, whose job it is to adjudicate on this sort of squabble, and Sarah Crown from the Guardian Books team. Sarah, would you start by reading out the offending passage?
Yes, it came up in a discussion of the word jejun, and Martin Amis wrote, on its journey from meaning scanty, arid, to meaning immature, callow, jejun has acquired an extra vowel and an acute accent, plus italicisation as a Gallicism. That's a mouthful. He added, we watch such developments, in this case the gradual deportation of an English word into French, as we would watch the progress of a virus. Like babesiosis and fog fever, such viruses afflict cattle and buffalo and wildebeest. They are the maladies of the herd.
Aha, said several scientists. Got him there. Babesiosis and fog fever aren't viruses. But we on the Guardian Books desk suspected this was more of a grammatical fog than an actual error of fact, so we called in Chris Elliott. Chris, can you take the story up from there?
Yes, I mean, the professors had correctly identified the fact that babesiosis and fog fever were not viruses. And if you look at that sentence quickly, and certainly if you say it, you do get the impression that he's making the point that they are. But the reality is if you look at the punctuation, if you look at the grammar of the thing, it's quite clear he's written it very carefully to ensure that there are new clauses. So another way of reading that sentence is we watch such developments, brackets, in this case, the gradual deportation of an English word into French, close brackets, as we would watch the progress of a virus, semicolon. So we then move into another clause, which is like babesiosis and fog fever, comma, such viruses afflict cattle and buffalo and wildebeest, semicolon. They are the maladies of the herd. So if you take care of the punctuation, you can see that he was not saying that these two things are viruses. They are like viruses.
So in fact, he was using it in its actually properly, wasn't it? Which is something that very few people do.
Yeah, yes. And if you read the extract from the Saturday Review, the extract from the introduction to the King's English, it is beautifully written. And whatever people think of Martin Amis, and certainly in the latter years, that is beautifully written and it's a lot of fun. And he clearly does care about the language.
Now, Kingsley Amis, in Martin's article, cites a number of words which have been used improperly, words such as infamous and decimate. Are these words that you have problems with on The Guardian?
We have somewhere in the region of 100 complaints and queries a day, and many of them are about language. Many of them, I ask my colleague David Marsh, who's the editor of The Guardian Style Guide, what his view is, because I would not suggest that I'm a grammarian, although 40 years as a journalist means you have to have some understanding of the way grammar works. But people really, really, really care about imprecise language. And I have to say, it is the role of the journalist to be clear in what they say and what they mean.
Sarah, you take a slightly different view, don't you?
I do, yes. I think that I completely agree with Chris on the grammar point. I think if you are looking at a sentence and you want to know what that sentence means, what the person who wrote it meant it to mean, you look at the grammar and those are the signposts that show you, as we saw with the sentence from Martin Amis's piece. But in terms of the meaning of words, I think we actually enter a really difficult and problematic area there, because there aren't precise definitions for words. The meanings of words change all the time. That's the way that language works. It's in a constant state of flux. And that's a wonderful thing. I think that's an absolutely wonderful thing. And if you're looking for examples, in Amis's piece, he cites the word awful as a word that we misuse. We should use it to mean awe-inspiring. That's what it originally meant. And now we tend to use it more loosely to mean dreadful. But the fact of the matter is that the way that we use it is what it means, because it's just a way of communicating.
What line would you take, Chris, on awful?
The problem is, and actually, as he says in the book, Kingsley Amis was a lot more relaxed about the actual change in the nature of words than people might think, given the kind of attitude he had. But my view is there is a transitional period when a perfectly good word, which has an agreed definition, it starts to be mangled. And I think he has come up with things like refute, things like decimate. Look, as a reporter, I was taught that you never, ever use the word post-mortem unless you have the word examination after it. It's an adjective, not a noun. But even in the Guardian Style Guide now, we have post-mortem as a noun. When I see someone's, you know, they're doing the post-mortem at the moment, that to me simply says they're doing the after-death. The after-death what? But it is widely accepted that a post-mortem means post-mortem examination. But it's during that transitional period where we become loose and slack, and decimate does mean 1 in 10, and refute does mean to prove absolutely that something is wrong. And absolute, the word that drives me crazy than anything else is when people misuse infer for imply. And I don't think that you're going to ever get infer to it. Will if, even if the Oxford English Dictionary takes it up, if they tell me that infer should mean imply, I think I'll give up altogether.
Should you be laying down the law like this? Should newspapers be making these sort of pronouncements, or should we just be following?
No, that's a really interesting question. No, of course, newspapers shouldn't be laying down the law. But newspapers should have an absolute duty to write clear and precise English, to make things understandable for people. And therefore, while we shouldn't chase demotic changes, I think what we should do is be very careful about before we make the move to accept that this word has changed. And sometimes that means being a pace behind, and therefore avoiding confusion. And sometimes that should be leading. For instance, in the area of the language around mental ill health, there have been many changes there which actually have changed the way we think about people with mental ill health problems. And we've moved with those changes. So we don't misuse clinical definitions, or we try not to. We occasionally break those rules and we then try to reinforce them. But for instance, all of us would find it naturally to say, I think that's a mad idea. Well, we occasionally get letters saying, please don't use mad in that way. Now, right now, I think that is sufficiently understood that that is not demeaning for people. But in 5 years' time, it may be that such a well of opinion builds that we will take the step to change using mad in that way. We will change bonkers and crazy in that way.
Sarah, one of the interesting things about the King's English, and this Martin Amis piece was an introduction to a reissue of it, is in a way it's a period piece, isn't it, in terms of the particular pedantries of Kingsley Amis?
Yes, I suppose, as Chris was saying, really, these things move on. They move on so quickly. And again, that's one of the great joys of language and being in a position in a job where you're watching language, is that, as you say, you see the shift happening, you see the kind of the tide going in and out with post-mortem, which was the example that you used. But I was going to say, I think that Chris and I are coming at this from slightly different perspectives, because Chris is talking about language as it's used in a newspaper, which is dealing in hard facts.
Instrumental
Absolutely.
Language.
Absolutely. Yes, that's a great way of putting it. Whereas in literature, and particularly if you think about poetry, the flexibility of words and their ability to convey several meanings at the same time is often what gives poetry and literature its depth and its resonance. And so where you might celebrate the looseness of a word in a book or in a poem, I can, of course, understand why in a newspaper the difference between infer and imply is a really crucial one.
Well, we'll have to leave the debate there, I'm afraid, but I dare say this item will provoke plenty more comments and we will go on talking about it for many years to come. Thank you very much, Chris. It all makes more work for you. Kingsley Amis's The King's English with That Introduction by Martin has just been reissued by Penguin Modern Classics. It's almost exactly a year ago that The New Yorker released their prestigious 20 under 40 list of the most exciting writers coming out of the US. I remember it well because I had to take time out from the Hay Festival to write a quick comment piece. I was lucky that many had already featured on The Guardian first book long and short list, so I knew the work. What struck me was the tremendously different energies that are pouring into the English language novel, along with the immigrants from around the world. China and Ethiopia had their place in the lists, with very distinctive voices and rather restrained novels. And then there was Taya Obrecht's novel The Tiger's Wife and David Besmozgis's The Free World. Taya's from former Yugoslavia and David's from Latvia. Both have written boisterous novels which draw on a rich range of storytelling traditions. We've brought them together to talk about how much their Eastern European roots have shaped them and their writing. Firstly, assuming that neither are yet quite household names, I'm going to ask each of them to give us a potted summary of their novels. Taya, will you start by explaining The Tiger's Wife in not as many words as there are in the book?
Sure, thank you. It's a novel about a young doctor named Natalia, who is operating in an unnamed province of the former Yugoslavia. And she gets a call while on a mission of mercy across the border that her grandfather, her beloved grandfather, has died under mysterious circumstances. And the novel is basically a novel of memory during which she tries to piece together his life and the circumstances of his death from stories that he told her about his time as a doctor and his childhood as well.
So just tell us briefly what the significance of the title is. Who is the Tiger's Wife?
The Tiger's Wife is a young deaf-mute Muslim woman in the grandfather's village when he's a child. And she befriends an escaped zoo tiger in the mountains during a very snowbound winter.
And this is a tiger that's escaped from Belgrade Zoo, is it?
From a zoo based on a city like Belgrade, but not quite Belgrade itself.
But Belgrade, yeah. We know that Belgrade Zoo was bombed and the zoo was bombed, don't we? And that we know that from a Kusturica film, apart from other things.
So this is
not literal history, but it does draw on history.
Yes, definitely.
So now, David, your turn. Tell us about The Free World.
So The Free World takes place in 1978. It's about a family of Soviet Jews who leave Latvia en route to the West. And the action takes place in Rome, which is where Soviet immigrants at the time had to go to be processed to go elsewhere. So it follows three generations of this family, Krasnansky, as they determine where they're going to go next and reflect back on where they came from.
Now, your family made a similar journey when you were very young. Is this how autobiographical is this?
Well, my family left in 1978. In 1979. This book is set in 78. It's a very different family, though the experience is similar. In fact, all Soviet Jews who ended up in North America and points west before the fall of the Soviet Union had to go through this.
Mm-hmm. When I read it, it made me think of the picaresque novels, particularly novels like Candide almost. These are sort of people who are stuck, ordinary people stuck in a huge sweeps of history. Was that something that was conscious for you?
Very much so. I mean, the reason that it's set in Rome is because it was this really peculiar moment historically, but also for this emigration, where you have these people from the East who never thought they'd get West. And it's this culture clash, which is disorienting, but also very funny. And so this is why I really set it at this point, to get the full range of the experience, which some of which was comic and some of it was tragic.
Mm. And they're in some ways they're larger than life, these characters, but they're also smaller than life in that they're sort of powerless, aren't they? They just have to wait for endless bureaucracies to process them.
Well, they have to wait, but it's also people who are really caught up in historical forces that are much larger than any one person, but that affect them intimately. And so, yes, you're a small individual and you're trying to break through to have your own, you know, private, independent life. But they're just forces that are so far beyond your control that, you know, exert its influence on you.
One of the things I noticed was that amused me really was the characters trying not to appear too big. They're trying to make themselves small. And I wondered whether you might read just one little episode which illustrates this, which is about a shooting competition between the two main characters.
Oh, right. I see what you mean. Okay. So, yes, I'll read from this. This is, the book is told in three voices. One of these is, so it's a family traveling together, three generations. The patriarch, his two sons, one of whom is kind of a handsome womanizer, and that son's Russian wife. So here's how they actually court each other. Before the start of the events, Alex sought Polina out and tried to strike a bargain with her. He told her that he wanted to see her again. "You're seeing me now," Polina said. "One more evening," Alex said. "All I ask. In the scheme of a life, what's one evening? Depends who you spend it with." "A valid point," Alex said. To reach the decision, Alec proposed a contest. If he scored better at the rifle range, Polina would grant him another evening. If she scored better, he would leave her in peace. Perhaps because she was beguiled by the prospect of a game, Polina agreed. "I should warn you in advance," Alec said. "Last summer, in the officer's training rotation, I placed 8th in marksmanship." "Out of how many?" Polina asked. 16, Alec said. "That doesn't sound very good," Polina said. "No, it doesn't," Alec said. "That's the idea." "I don't understand," Polina said. "Well, I was specifically trying for 8th place." "Why is that?" "In the army, it's best to be somewhere in the middle. Trouble usually finds those at the bottom or at the top." "So you mean to say you're a good shot?" 8th place, Alex said. "In that case, I should tell you that last year at Readiness for Labor and Defense, I finished 2nd in my department. They awarded me a ribbon and printed my name in the factory newspaper. My husband pasted a copy of it into an album." Alec noticed that Polina didn't brandish the word husband like a cudgel. She seemed to place the same emphasis on husband as she did on ribbon or album. But Alec wasn't fool enough to believe that she'd included the word innocently. In a sense, since she hadn't unequivocally rebuffed Alec, anything she said about her husband verged on betrayal. Any information Alec had about him was information he could use against him. For instance, the fact that he was the kind of man who would preserve something printed in the factory's idiotic newspaper. Then again, it was possible that Polina found such a gesture endearing. It could be that she was implying that this was precisely the kind of man she wanted, a man unlike Alec, who, in his ironical sophistication, couldn't hope to access or appreciate such pure sentimental feeling.
So you get a sense there of there's a real generational pull in it as well, isn't there? It's not just, although it's set in the 1970s, it's not, it looks back. In fact, both these novels look back to the 1940s. Well, yours looks back further than that, to very early in the 20th century.
Precisely. And also because of what was happening over the course of, you know, the 20th century in the Soviet Union, how different generations related to it. So for instance, the patriarch, this man named Samuel, was a true believer for whom communism was something he took in earnest. Whereas by the time you see his son here, it's to him, it's a lark, it's a joke. Mm-hmm. Nobody believes in the system anymore. Mm. And basically just have to get along with it because they don't have a choice.
Let's move now to the Tiger's Wife and to Natalia, who has a rather different... Your attitude to the grandfather is rather different, isn't it? The grandfather is a very romantic figure in a way.
I think so, yeah.
Will you read us a little bit about that places him Absolutely. For his granddaughter?
"Everything necessary to understand my grandfather lies between two stories, the story of the Tiger's Wife and the story of the Deathless Man. These stories run like secret rivers through all the other stories of his life, of my grandfather's days in the army, his great love for my grandmother, the years he spent as a surgeon and a tyrant of the university. One, which I learned after his death, is the story of how my grandfather became a man. The other, which he told to me, is of how he became a child again."
Lovely. So you get a sense there of how people making themselves through stories.
Yes.
And tell us about the Deathless Man. We've talked a bit about the tiger.
The Deathless Man is a figure that the grandfather meets at several points throughout his life and throughout the book, and is basically encapsulated in stories that he tells to Natalia. Basically, throughout, the only way people know one another is through stories and through myth-making. And the Deathless Man is a vagabond who claims to be immortal, whom the grandfather meets. And because the grandfather's a doctor, this is quite a difficult thing for him to accept and even process.
Mm-hmm. There's something that's quite difficult for people who are totally steeped in realist novels to take about this, because the people... they're constantly upstaged by their own stories, aren't they?
Yes. I think that in the Balkans, certainly, there's, you know, it's a tradition of oral storytelling. And the stories that people tell, even if it's something as simple as I went around the corner and bought a loaf of bread today, it's never that simple. It always becomes this larger-than-life epic, because people are constantly painting themselves and their own activities as something grandiose that happened, like this marvel of, you know, this marvel of a day, when in reality it was totally mundane. So I think that feeds really significantly into fable and fable being a part of everyday existence, which is, you know, not really a realist kind of thing.
Is that very different to the tradition you're writing from, David?
I think so, even though there's certainly a history of sort of absurdist writing in Russian. I mean, we could talk about Gogol and others. But the way you describe, you know, day-to-day life or interactions between people in the Balkans, that isn't my experience of, you know, the Soviet people, Russian people, which are far more, I mean, it's a more ironical, dry sort of interaction between people. With this sense of, you know, knowing that there are these, you know, larger forces that have made your life miserable.
Mm. So you're not in control of the story of your life in the same way as Taya's characters are.
Not only are you not in control, but it's like this sort of silent, unspoken thing where everybody basically knows, as you talk to people, that you should be able to keep certain things unspoken because you share this common miserable history. But it's like, even if, you know, you're kind of naive, if you say fairly obvious things, it's like, oh, yes, yes, we don't need to say that. We know that.
Mm. Let's talk about the humor a little bit in the free world. It comes a lot out of the characters, isn't it? They're sort of slightly buffoonish, aren't they? I mean, Alec, for example, is a sort of serial philanderer, not very smart about it. You know he's going to get busted.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't know he's going to get busted. But as far as where the humor comes from, it's being part of, you know, being trapped in a system that leaves you very little choice. And therefore, you have to make the best of it. So you can't go and complain, you know, to the authorities to say, I'd like to change this. So it's a joke. You know, either you deal with it through humor or you deal with it through tears, right? Laughter or tears. And, you know, Russian people, and particularly Russian Jews, who suffered more than, you know, the Russians. You know, there's this great tradition of Jewish humor, which I'm sure I'm not, you know, discovering America by telling you this. And it comes from this same sort of thing where you're powerless in the face of a greater force. The only thing you can do is kind of mock it.
Nevertheless, you've put your characters at a moment of choice because they can choose to go to America or Canada or Australia, but in particular this moment, can't they?
They can choose, but they're also, so yes, they're given a moment of choice, but it's also at the very first kind of inkling where you actually have the ability to choose. And you're still at forces that are kind of beyond you because you're applying for these various places. Will America accept me? Will Canada accept me? Will Australia accept me? And you're making these choices based on very little information. So there's this level of ignorance and anxiety and culture clash. Mm. And yes, you could say, you know, arguably, these people should really relax because things are going to go much better for them now. But psychologically and historically, the forces still exert their power over them.
Mm. There's a nice line from Samuel. How do you pronounce it?
Samuel.
Samuel, the patriarch, who says, how do we keep from falling and breaking our necks? That I can tell you in one word, traditions.
Well, that's not Samuel, my friend. That's actually from Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay, yeah. It's Samuel quoting Fiddler on the Roof.
It's actually, they're made to watch Fiddler on the Roof. It's this very bizarre thing where the Soviet Jews were shown movies that are supposed to appeal to them. One was Exodus, which was played repeatedly, and the other was Fiddler on the Roof. And so they're all, these Soviet Russian Jews are watching Fiddler on the Roof, and it's being simultaneously translated by a Jew called the Mountain Jew from the Caucasus, who actually doesn't speak Russian very well. And so he's getting certain things wrong. And in fact, the line is, that I can tell you in one word, our traditions. So in fact, he even gets that wrong. So they're just sitting and watching that.
So it's about the misappropriation of tradition, which brings us in a way to back to the tiger's wife. And what is it that the grandfather, the dearly beloved grandfather, carries in his back pocket? It's The Jungle Book by Kipling. What is the significance of The Jungle Book to you?
To me,
well, or to them?
Well, to the characters, it's basically a talisman of his life. It's something that he had as a child that was given to him by a character who meant very much to him, by the village apothecary. In his childhood home, and it's something through which he comes to understand what a tiger is, just sort of conceptually. Which was how it started out in terms of the writing. It was just supposed to be this mechanism for him to understand what a tiger is, and then turned out to be something that he carries around with him as a memento of his time with the tiger's wife and his childhood in general, and comes to, you know, accumulate all this baggage of a whole life, basically.
I kept thinking of Bashevis Singer when I was reading The Tiger's Wife, in the mix of sort of myth and almost fairy story and superstition. And
I take that as a very high compliment, having, you know, been acquainted with his work more recently. But recently I've become aware and sort of very interested in more Eastern, but, you know, the Balkan forms, the Balkan traditions of storytelling, which also relate to Russian traditions of storytelling, which focus very much on event, I think, and have a lot to do with plot and epic journeys, even if it's, you know, not necessarily as absurdist as Balkan fiction. You know, Russian fiction has a lot to do with these grand stories. And Western fiction has a lot to do with character development and the exploration of a character and character conflict. And so I think that coming from, you know, a background of both, it was very important for me to be able to do both and blend them somehow. And I think that fable and then reality became the only way to do it.
The Tiger's Wife by Teja Obrecht is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, and The Free World by David Bezmoskis is published by Viking. Now, we've heard all about the tiz over grammar, but another issue has got our readers just as hot under the collar this week. The incredible shrinking presence of women science fiction writers, as our headline put it. Sarah, could you tell us a bit about this?
Yes, as part of a special on science fiction that ran in the Guardian Review a couple of weeks ago, the Guardian Review editors asked lots of very prominent science fiction writers to nominate their favourite science fiction book. And then we extended this online and asked all of our users to nominate their favourites. And we had more than 500 recommendations in total, which seemed very encouraging about the health of science fiction. But a sharp-eyed blogger in Seattle by the name of Nicola Griffiths noticed that only 18 of the recommendations were for women writers.
That is really bad, isn't it? Well, we've got Gwyneth Jones on the line to give us her thoughts on this. As many of you will know, she's one of the UK's most successful female science fiction writers. She won the Arthur C. Clarke Award in 2002 with Boulder's Love and the Philip K. Dick Award 2 years later with Life, among others. Gwyneth, welcome. Can you tell us why there is such an extreme imbalance?
I think to start with, it was historical when the science fiction as we know it today was born in the early first half of the 20th century, and it was the popular literature, non-literary literature, of the technically skilled working class. And most of the readers and most of the writers were men. Most of the skilled female working class probably were holding down two full-time jobs at least, so they didn't have time to take up a fascinating hobby. So there's this historical imbalance, and that's kind of legitimate because it was based on sheer numbers and by forces beyond the genre's control. But things did change dramatically in the 70s when the Women's Liberation Movement took over the genre for a whole decade. Their ideas hit the spot with the U.S. Cultural Revolution of the time, and everybody wanted to read Chip Delaney, Ursula Le Guin, James Tiptree, Joanna Russ, Susie Charnas, and they were writing about things well outside science fiction's traditional heart ground of male dominance and gadgets and weapons.
Now, you mentioned James Tiptree. What's James Tiptree doing in there?
Well, James Tiptree was actually, it turned out, the pseudonym of a woman called Alice Sheldon, who was writing from 1967 to 1977 as a man, and also taking quite a public part in the US science fiction's feminist movement, and accepted there as a man who had feminist opinions.
Do you think that there might be other pseudonymous writers that we don't know about who are actually women?
Today, no, I don't think so. Honestly, hand on heart, I am not secretly writing as Richard Morgan. You see, it was the revolutionary content of Tiptree's work that was exciting, not so much that he was a man, but that he was a man writing very critically about what men did to women, about how women were mistreated, and men loved him for that, as long as they thought it was a man who was being so sexually candid. Yeah. They liked him for nailing them. But now, well, if there are men writing as women, or if there are women writing as men, and they're sticking to the traditional values of the science fiction boys' club, I don't see what difference that would make.
So now, are there lots of them that I should know about writing, for example, in the UK? Where are these women writers now?
I think, well, the younger SF writers who are female today, I don't think they're trying to break into the fortress, not this time round. I think genre fiction has changed and become more fluid. You don't have to be an accredited sci-fi writer anymore. You don't have to be writing within the science fiction community to use science fiction themes or write about science fiction ideas. I think it's rather the other way around. You can be a writer outside the science fiction community and a woman, and that can be a way of gaining respect within the community.
Can you give us five, there's a challenge for you, five women science fiction writers or writers in that sort of area that we should all be reading?
Five women science fiction writers of today. Now that is going to be difficult for me because they are not particularly necessarily visible. Women may be writing fantasy because they're encouraged to write fantasy, and they could really be writing science fiction, and that bias could hide them. And women are hidden if they're not being published by traditional means. I'm really struggling if I'm going strictly within genre, if I go beyond Tricia Sullivan and Justina Robson.
And what about Ursula Le Guin?
Well, she's past 80 now, and she's a wonderful writer, but one looks around and wonders who's going to take her place.
Thank you very much. That's really interesting, and I'm sure we'll get lots of feedback from that. But that's it for this week. Sarah, can you tell us about some of the things we've got coming up?
Yes, in the Guardian Review on Saturday, we've got Michael Cunningham on Virginia Woolf and the longlist for our 2011 Children's Fiction Prize, along with the launch of a Young Critics competition. And the Observer New Review on Sunday has an interview with James Daunt, who's just been hired by the new owners of Waterstones to come in and run the company.
Thanks, Sarah. Now, our regular producer, Tim Mabey, will kill me if I don't make our usual plea to you to become regular subscribers to this podcast on iTunes or to come to it through guardian.co.uk/books. We'll be back next week with the results of the Orange Prize, among other things. Until then, thanks to Thea Obrecht, David Besmozgis, Chris Elliott, Sarah Crown, and our producer, Vivian Perry. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.